This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Happy Rex Manning Day, Junkions!
Yes!
Heck yeah!
It's Rex Manning Day!
It's Rex Manning Day here at Junk Food Cinema, the weekly cult and exploitation film cast that is so good you almost miss a beat when you're saying it, but then you don't because you're a motherfucking professional. FilmSchoolRejects.com.
That's right.
If you would like to hear
dot
more,
cam.
Dot cam. I am Brian. He is Cargill. Lieutenant of Megaforce.
That's right.
Songwriter of Mia Moore, Mona Moore, Say No More, Mona Moore. And
I really wish I'd written that.
The residuals alone from all of the people who you used to be their favorite singer in high school would just be astronomical.
It'd be through the roof.
Through the roof. Speaking of through the roof, we have a stack of old episodes on Libsyn. No, forget it. It's done. You know what? I'm just pulling the plug right now. The show's over. Go home, folks. Go home, everybody. No, we have a stack of old episodes on Stitcher as well as on iTunes that you can go back and check out. And I promise you, I'm more put together on those episodes than I am right now for some reason.
You are, well, you have just had an experience.
I did.
You had never seen Empire Records.
I had never seen Empire Records.
Do you think the story is already written, or do you think a bold and courageous act can change the course of history?
The staff of Empire Records had the coolest jobs on Earth. Lucas blew it. Everyone knew it.
You want to buy Empire?
Well, that's a good thing, right?
The money is gone.
Where's it going to?
I think it's recirculating.
We're turning us into a music town?
I have to pay for what Mr. Brilliant here did.
Now, five friends have one day to decide what to do with the rest of their lives. AJ loves Corey, not the whole story.
Today is the day that I'm going to tell Corey how I feel about her. That I
love her.
Yeah.
Do you think that it's possible for someone to be in love with someone else and not even know it?
In this life, there are nothing but possibilities.
That is so sweet, I think I'm going to barf.
Deb shaved her head and made out she was dead.
I tried to kill myself with a lady bit.
Just your typical nutty teenager.
You did have hair, right?
I was tired of being invisible.
Gina did it again, this time to a friend.
You get smarter the shorter your skirt gets.
Empire Records, featuring the music of Better Than Ezra, Gin Blossoms, Ape Hangers, Evan Dando, Toad the Wet Sprocket, and the Cranberries.
What is wrong with you people?
Rock and roll.
And this is one of those movies that I have loved for 20 years. Like, this is one of those movies that I saw right when it came out on VHS, and I have held close to my heart. It has been on the short list of movies to do for quite some time.
By the way, we need to stop calling that a short list. It's huge.
It's
that list is expansive.
The short list is a long list. It's
conundrum.
It is a very long list. In fact, we have a barn burner of a Ooh. Bonus episode for the Junkions this
yeah.
weekend, and it was one of those things where you gave me this really like narrow band of movies to choose from. To
narrow band
top five out
of the hand,
and we'll get into that on that episode. But it was one of those things that I went through, and I'm like, oh, here's seven different movies we have to do episodes on from this, you know, this little tiny list. Like, it was crazy. And I was like, oh my God, we have to do episodes on all of these movies. Jesus fucking Christ. We are never, ever going to run out of content on this show.
No.
But man, this week's episode, Empire Records, you had never seen it. We have not talked about it yet.
No. And if you would like to hear the episode that Cargill is talking about with the narrowest of focus of probably any top five we've ever done, you need to go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema and become a patron of the show, as many of you have done, and we very much appreciate it. All you got to do is throw in a few shekels per episode, and if you do that, you will get access to that bonus content. And as Cargill said, this week's is a doozy. So just a little shout out for our patron one more time, patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. And yes, you're right. I had never seen Empire Records, and this is one of those rare situations in which my fiance was actually like, wait a minute, what movie are you covering? And I was like, Empire Records. And she got like giddy, excited, and like one of her favorite movies of all time. She had it on DVD. So I've seen the like extended cut with all the extra footage because we watched it on the DVD. So yeah, this was definitely, and I feel like this is a good pairing with an episode we did a couple weeks ago, Pump Up the Volume.
It is perfect for that because mm-hmm. this is actually the third film in Alan Moyle's unrecognized music trilogy.
And I'm just now realizing it's the same director.
It's the same director. It is. He directed a film.
Way to do your research, Brian.
2 weeks ago, one of the films that I proposed to you was a film called Times Square, which is a film that I've been fortunate enough to see on the big screen twice because it comes around to the Draft House every few years. He directed that in 1980. And then in 1990, we had Pump Up the Volume. And then in 95, we had Empire Records. Alan Moyle was a musician. He was a music guy. He came out of the punk scene. So he had fantastic taste in music, just amazing taste in music, put together these incredible soundtracks on like Times Square. And as we talked about Pump Up the Volume, and here this soundtrack was blisteringly cool. In fact, this movie has a very troubled release and is one of those great success stories of cult films, and we'll get into that in a moment. But upon release, it was slagged by critics and who all even said yeah, but the soundtrack's amazing. Like even Roger Ebert's like, this movie's terrible, but it's it is a this soundtrack is really great.
Yeah, I remember his review was, but that soundtrack though
no, but the thing is the critics were fucking wrong, and the studio, which got really nervous about this was supposed to be a big hit for Warner Brothers. This was going to be a big deal. They were like, we're gonna do this is another Pump Up the Volume, this is gonna be huge. They then got really nervous because production was really weird. The film was massively re-edited. Three characters were entirely deleted from the cut. So you had the theatrical. Later on, it would be re-released with a director's cut that still didn't put all that together. But everyone inside Warner Bros. Apparently was really skittish about it. So they released it limited, and they dumped it on like 50 screens. Mm-hmm. And it made $273,000 theatrically.
Which is interesting that we're talking about it in January, which has now traditionally become the dump era, where you just dump things that you're not sure about if you're a studio.
And this was a movie that had a huge run-up because so many songs on the album got radio play in the 90s, and we were hearing about it. This is a new track from the Gin Blossoms off the, from the upcoming Empire Records soundtrack, and we kept hearing Empire Records, and then it never opened because it only opened in a few select markets, and they dumped it. And typically, this is the end of the story. This story happens so often. This is, a dozen to a couple dozen movies a year get unceremoniously dumped like this and then never get heard from again. People like, oh yeah, I caught that on DVD. That was terrible. There's so much as film critics, when you and I were working film critics, doing, the day to day grind, so many movies that we saw that ended up getting dumped like that. Just so that they'd played it in Austin, hoping it would get some kind of, press coverage. And this was one of those movies, but then it came out on VHS and it found an audience instantly, and it became a beloved cult classic. And so this is one of those rare, really great success stories where a movie that did not do well ended up, here we are 21 years later talking about it. It got a 20th anniversary release. Again, it has been put out multiple times. It's always available. And when you bring it up, people like your fiance light up, and it's like, yeah. Oh, I love Empire Records. And, Rex Manning Day is a meme, for Christ's sake. Yeah. It's one of those things you could say, not on Rex Manning Day. And you will find your people.
So, embarrassing admission, not only had I never seen this movie, I apparently had seen the movie High Fidelity, not as much as I thought I had. I guess I've only seen it once and don't remember it as well as I thought I did. Because whenever I had heard someone say, not today, not on Rex Manning Day, I thought it was a quote from High Fidelity for some reason.
Oh.
So
oh,
wow. I saw it in this movie, and I was like, oh, wait, it's not. So, yeah, the thing with my fiance is that her barometer for whether or not a movie is good starts with the soundtrack. If a movie has a really solid soundtrack, she will forgive a lot. And if it doesn't, not so much. So I knew I was in for something very eclectic, something very modern as far as modern to the time. And sure enough, this movie feels like it is like one step away from being a jukebox musical, because so many of the songs of that time are just pumping through this movie. Like it is like it really is like if James Gunn or David Ayer was in charge. It's just like song after song after song after song, which in this movie actually makes sense, where in other movies that does get annoying. In this movie makes sense because they're working at a goddamn record store.
Oh, yeah.
So that totally gels and I get it. What I found most intriguing about Empire Records is that it is, just like So I Married an Axe Murderer, 100% a time capsule movie.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
This movie is carved out of the bedrock of the 90s.
It cannot exist as a movie functionally today. If you were to remake Empire Records, you could
first you'd have to find a record store. Good luck.
Well, it would but the record store would have to be all vinyl, and it would be for vinyl collectors. Like, and it would not be the kind of center that Empire Records was. Like, it would be like you'd have to sit in a store like High Fidelity, would not a high traffic store like in Empire Records, where that was what stores were like in the 90s. Like, mm-hmm. you would have these, you know, these crazy large stores that would just have tons of people in it, because that was the only way you could fucking get music. Like, it was listen to the radio or go to the fucking record store.
Right.
And yeah, and the clothing in this.
Oh my God, so many fuzzy half, like midriff sweaters, so many tiny skirts, so many combat boots.
So much flannel.
So much flannel. It's like a brawny paper towel ad, the amount of flannel that's in this movie. It is insane.
That is what the 90s fucking look like.
Yeah.
Like, like the difference between this and So I Married an Axe Murderer is So I Married an Axe Murderer is, as a comedy, it looks like it was a parody made today of what we remember the 90s to be
right.
like. This is what the 90s actually look like.
This is more like season one of Friends 90s, where it's like, oh, they don't know how ridiculous this is going to look in just 8 years.
Yes. Yeah. You do not. But some of that stuff's coming back, man. Chokers, flannel on girls, you know, it's all becoming hip again.
Oh, raise your hand if just last year you went to a Gin Blossoms concert. You can't see it over the radio, but my hand is currently in the air.
Oh, Jesus. You actually saw the Gin Blossoms.
Do you think that would be all right if I just crashed here tonight?
Yeah.
We could drive around this town. No, I'm not going to do the... But the
down
point
to Allison
is,
Road?
Down to Allison Road. Oh, my God. B-side.
Yeah, let's pretend that I don't know the Gin Blossoms for a second.
Okay, so here's the other thing. And this is why it's been in my head. And it's so funny, because the other thing I'm working on right now is I'm watching the entirety of the Resident Evil franchise, because it's a franchise, so I'm interested.
Because you love to torture yourself.
Because I do. And I don't remember anything about any of those movies individually. And what I noticed is that Mia Jovovich dresses like she's on her way to a Cranberries concert through that whole franchise. With that, like, half-torn dress and the combat boots. I'm just like, she just has to let that look linger, I guess. So
I love how you threw that in there so that you could just leave that subtle joke dangling about zombie.
Because I have to. But yeah, that was the most fun for me watching this movie, is it feels so of its era that it really is like being in a time machine. And the characters in this movie don't really exist on planet Earth. They exist on planet 90s. You know what I mean?
Can I go live on planet 90s? And planet 90s, Trump is a board game.
Yes, exactly. Trump is making cameos in Home Alone 2 and not really a problem for us. Yeah, no, I would love to live on planet 90s. And in fact, I think one of the hollowed out former Planet Hollywoods in Miami is where you find Planet 90s. So it's easily achievable.
Let's open a Planet 90s restaurant here.
Oh, we
in
could.
Town
we where, totally could.
Yeah, that would. Yeah, but no, you're absolutely right. Like, these characters are very much rooted in that era. It is a warm hug from 1995.
It's a who's who of, hey, remember them?
Well, God. And at the time, this cast was young unknowns.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people didn't know who Renee Zellweger was.
Nope.
They did not know Anthony LaPaglia. They did not know Ethan Embry. They did not know Rory Cochran.
They knew
Liv Tyler was just
the vixen in all her dad's music videos.
Yeah, like, mm-hmm. this was the movie that you're seeing all this raw talent of all these people with their fingers crossed going, I hope I can make it after this. And, like, most of the cast fucking does.
And there's something so at odds about that, because you have that, like, bright-eyed hopefulness from this whole cast, and that like you can feel like simmering underneath their performances is the hope that this is going to be their big break. But then the movie itself, because it's the 90s, is so angsty that you have a very bright-eyed cast who seem very hopeful in terms of being performers in this like 90s unearned angst, because there's a lot of like causeless angst in 90s movies, I've noticed. Like, and in this movie, I think it is at odds with the fact that you have a cast that is so young and on their way up.
Well, this is one of those things that's what was so weird about the 90s. The 90s is a time very much was in love with the 60s. Mm-hmm. And the 50s at the same time. Like the 90s is what happens when you take kind of 50s beat culture and throw it in a blender with 60s activism, but then have a world where we don't have wars.
Yes. You know, yes.
The United States, it doesn't have wars. It doesn't, it feels like all the ideas have been done. That's, you know, what we hear that in Pump Up the Volume.
Yeah.
And we've got nothing to fight for in the sense of the way we see the world. And this is where it leads up to Fight Club. And I feel that Fight Club is the greatest example of what it was like to be a man in the 90s in terms of how it felt. Like you felt lost. You felt like there was nothing left. And we had no idea that we were just a few years away from the entire world losing its goddamn mind and then being thrown into daily activism, like where everybody's fighting for everything now.
Yeah.
And we didn't realize as a society how much we still had to fight for. We were like, yeah, everybody's equal now. Equality's here. We've got, you know, political correctness and everything's great. And so we don't have to work on that anymore. And here we are 20 years later going, oh shit. Yeah, no, that was really stupid of us.
We're pining for the days we could be angry about nothing. But yeah, you're right, though. In the 90s, all that coffee shop beatnik stuff, or all the beatnik movement moved into coffee shops. And then what Fight Club was taking a swing at was that exact sort of Starbucks liberalism, where it's like you are angsty and moody and you're writing all of this poetry, but it's like, why? What's so wrong in your life that you... And in fact, one of the biggest conflicts in this movie is, oh no, our independent store is going to be bought by a big corporation. So really, all we'd be losing is our ability to fuck around at work, because we're going to get the same products. It's nothing's really changing, except we won't be able to act like idiots at work anymore. And that is like the end of our world as we know it.
Yeah, no, it's somebody's coming and taking away our freedom. And it's something that everyone can identify with. I mean, that is a universal theme. And it seems so silly and small, mm-hmm. but it's kind of what's great about this movie. This movie's all about maintaining your independence in the face of American corporatism.
Yeah.
And that's why it connects, and why I feel like it still works. Like, even though it is a time capsule, it is still easy for someone in 2017 to sit down for the first time and watch it and go, holy shit, I love this.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed it very much. I will say that the one thing that bothered me throughout the whole movie was actually, and I hate to say this because I like him as an actor, especially now, is Ethan Embry. His character in this movie...
You don't like Mark?
His character is horny to the point of stupid. Like, it's like somehow him being like, I didn't know that sex could be the need in Special Needs. You know what I mean? But apparently that's what's going on with Ethan Embry's character, because he is so desperate for love that it's actually made him a blithering idiot. And he feels like his interactions with people are so fucking weird, and this movie is so 90s, and there's so much angst that it felt like the sequel to Clerks, and they just forgot to put the black and white filter on. It was like they're Clerks, but now they just work at like the Quick Stop record store, because like he reminded me of like the character in Snowball. The character in Clerks is just like, what universe is this person from? What is going on? The rest of this movie feels like it could be just normal people in a normal job, and then there's fucking Snowball. So
Mark is the comic, you know, part of the comic relief. And
is that what they were?
Yeah. He's
good to know.
Well, that's what's so interesting is like you've got, you know, the serious, moody guy who's in love with Liv Tyler and just needs to tell him. You've got AJ,
yep.
You know, and then you've got the two, the two other sides of the comic relief. You've got Mark as the stupid, you know, pseudo stoner, you know, musician who wants to join Gwar. And then you've got and start his own band, and then you've got Lucas on the other side, who is the darker, more sardonic Jedi master of comedy.
Yeah.
You know, where he's, you know, he's hilarious in this weird character change he's had. Which and Lucas in particular is the character I find the most interesting, because he really is that guy who's cracked.
Oh,
and
yeah.
He's suffering an existential crisis, and as a result, it's made him just weird, and all of his friends are like, what the fuck is going on with you, dude?
Oh, man, that turtleneck got so much higher throughout the movie. As soon as he found out they're going to be bought by a corporate chain, just like the turtleneck went to his ears.
Yeah. Now, which version did you watch? Now, this is one of the things I want
to
talk about.
Oh, yes, this is something to talk about.
There is two functionally different versions of this movie. There is the theatrical cut, which is fun, light, and awesome. And that is the best version of this movie. And then there's the director's cut, which they put out as the fan edit cut. Mm-hmm.
It's the Empire Records remix. Pew, 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 pew.
Yeah. Yeah. And by remixing it, it lost a lot of its magic. And I still watch it.
Demixed.
I have it. It's the only way you can get it digitally is the fan edition, even though they don't say that. So if you, mm-hmm. you know, if you bought it off Amazon, which I don't think they actually have for sale right now, but if you bought it previously, you have the director's cut. And the director's cut, it just doesn't have the, whoever edited that movie for the theatrical cut did a brilliant job of infusing it with energy that the director's cut consistently grinds to a halt. Like, mm-hmm. you know, in the opening of the movie, you know, Lucas is, you know, talks to Renee Zellweger about how he's going to close for the first time. And like, here's what I have to do. And these are the things I have to do. And then he looks at the character. He says, this is going to require the dedication and patience of a saint. And then in the theatrical cut, it cuts immediately to him, you know, playing drums on the money, and he's smoking the cigars and he's drinking the beer, all the things he's not supposed to be doing. But in the director's cut, it cuts to this long sequence of a truck driver's wife who is bored and wants to get laid. And that entire scene just goes fucking nowhere.
Yeah.
Like it's so unnecessary. And I mean, it's fine to watch, like, you know, being a fan of the movie, having an extra 16 minutes is like, all right, cool. It's 16 more minutes, except that it loses a lot of the fun. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those rare director's cuts that I would much, much prefer watching the theatrical cut over a director's cut.
Yeah, no. And I get that. And I feel like there's definitely a lot that was trimmed for good reason. And
which version did you watch? Did you watch the one with the truck driver's wife?
Or? Yeah, the version that I had, you could tell it was an OG DVD because it was Warner Brothers and it came in the cardboard case with the little like flip lock on it.
Yeah, the little flip lock.
Remember that bullshit?
Ugh,
I hated those. Even when I was younger and like first started collecting DVDs, they were like my least favorite ones. I'd be like, fucking Warner Brothers. All right, fine. But yeah, no, mine did have that. And I felt like it did really drag toward the end of the movie, probably because of all that extra stuff. But
oh, yeah, because the end of the movie in the theatrical is, it's just bam, 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 bam. Like, it is just flying. And then all of a sudden the movie's over and you're like, holy shit, that just flew by.
Yeah.
And the director's cut, sadly, is not, it's just not the same. It just drags at points, and that makes me it makes me very sad that that's the digital version I own. It's why I still have it on DVD, so that I can go back and rewatch that. But when I'm on the road and want to watch a version, I end up reluctantly watching it because I still love the shit out of this movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've run down a little bit of the cast, so I feel like this is one of the few movies where we get to do this. We should run down a little bit of the soundtrack and just tell you about the, like, I wouldn't even have to tell you what year this movie was made. If I just read the bands on the soundtrack, you would probably figure it out, because you have bands like the Gin Blossoms. You have bands like Cracker. You have bands like
Cranberries are on this.
Dishwalla, Better Than Ezra, Toad the Wet Sprocket, The Dire Straits, like I could go on and on and on. Yes, as you mentioned, the Cranberries have two different songs on the soundtrack. So yeah, just and then they throw in a little 80s there with the Buggles as well. And yeah, it's
and
Sponge.
Then, and then as if that's not enough, we have a song.
It's still going, by the way. The whole time I've been talking, I've been scrolling through, it's still going. The soundtrack, I'm not even at the bottom yet.
There's a song in the movie that they never released this version of the song. With Renee Zellweger singing, it's Sugar High. And so the only way you can actually find it is to find ripped audio from the movie that still has lines of dialogue in it and, you know, the crowd in the background. Like, you can't listen to a version of Sugar High. And Sugar High is so fucking great. Mm-hmm. It's such a good fucking song. And it's so sad that you can never actually sit down and listen to Sugar High, because the version that's on the album is actually, I think it's like it's played a little differently, and it doesn't have Renee Zellweger singing, so it sounds like a very different song than the high energy one that you're listening to in the fucking movie.
And this, and I feel like I do this too much, and I apologize, but I couldn't help thinking again as I was watching this movie that it reminded me a little bit of it actually reminded me of Shakespeare a little bit, but a comedy. It reminded me of something like Much Ado About Nothing, where you have, you know, characters that are in love, but they're like missing all their connections. So you got that farcical element. You literally have characters like hooking up with one another. You have characters on the periphery doing just fucking weird shit. Like,
you've got a character who's talking to the audience and breaking the fourth wall.
Yes, you have a fucking chorus of a character talking directly. And then you have a character who's kind of like the sheriff in Much Ado About Nothing, who's just so fucking out there in Mark that you're just like, that. I don't know what that guy's doing, but it just felt very, there was farcical and whimsical at the same time. It is snarky and dour at points, but also very romantic. It's just a weird kind of mix of things that it just, you know, it had that same feel for me of it, but it was clearly going for, like, you have this character who's gotten into Harvard and Liv Tyler, and like her whole life is ahead of her, and there's something, she's going to be leaving this place for something better, but oh no, she's also, you know, addicted to pills. She's basically Annie Adderall from Community. She's having a problem with the amphetamines, and yeah, so I liked that sort of, even though you have a very contemporary to the period, a very steeped in its own era movie, still had some kind of classical elements to it that make it, and that might be why, as you mentioned, I was able to sit down in 2017, you know, 20 plus years after this movie's been released, and still find a lot to enjoy about it.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's supposedly based on a real record store. Like, it was actually the screenwriter who wrote it was based on her Tower Records, where she worked. And people who worked there say that several of the things that happened in the film were actually things that had happened at the store. So that's an interesting little piece of mythology with it. But yeah, all of these characters do connect in some way. They're all interesting. They're all very interestingly drawn. And there is a classic farcical comedy element to the structure of this thing, which is why I feel like this movie really does work and really holds up. And not in a way that you ever feel you need to defend.
Right.
Like, it's one of those movies that, for some reason, as much as of a failure as it was at the box office and critically, man, has this fucking taken on a life of its own.
Oh,
and
for sure.
Become, you know, it is considered one of the great teen movies in the 90s.
Yeah.
It is, and rightly so. It's so much fun. I mean, that's the thing, is like, all those elements really do work. It's a very simple problem. It's something everyone can relate to. Nobody wants to, you know, everybody knows the everybody's had some kind of job or some kind of thing in their life where you're part of something small and private, and you know, working at a place. I had I worked at a video store here in town that was very much like this, called I Love Video, which was
still around, by the way.
Is one of the few video stores still around.
All of the big guys, Blockbuster, Hollywood, all crumbled here in Austin, but I Love and Vulcan, the local stores, still around.
I worked for both Hollywood and Blockbuster, and yeah, they went away, but sure enough, I Love Video. In fact, ironically, I was working at I Love Video, at the end of the 90s, and they had opened a Blockbuster just down the street, and the Blockbuster execs came in to check out the competition. And they, one of the execs, I swear to God, actually laughed and said, yeah, you guys will be gone in 6 months. And sure enough, that's the location on 29th Street, which is still there today. What happened to the Blockbuster? Gone.
First of all, I can tell you this from working at Blockbuster. Those executives who came in, they didn't last 6 months. That place had more turnover than a fucking bakery. It was ridiculous. But yeah, you're right. The local stores exist. And Blockbuster, it was a lot of fun as a movie collector prior to streaming media being ubiquitous to go and pick the fucking carcass of a Hollywood or a Blockbuster clean when they had to liquidate their entire stock.
Oh, God, those sales were so great.
Like $2, $3 for DVDs, and you just come out with a stack. It was a gorgeous thing.
You know, while we're talking, but since this is thematically appropriate for this episode, worst thing I've ever done in my life, I, as a film fan, it still to this day breaks my heart. I was working at Blockbuster when they finally pulled their head out of their ass and got into DVD. They resisted DVD for a lot of years because the head of DVD, the head of Blockbuster had gotten so burned on Laserdisc, he insisted DVD was never going to take off. And by the way, if Blockbuster didn't pick up DVD, it wasn't going to take off. So fuck you guys for studios for burning us before with
DVD will be gone in 6 months. It's like, you got to stop saying everything will be gone in 6 months.
That's the thing is at the time, if you read the video journals of the time 15 years ago, that's exactly what they were fucking saying. They said it was never going to take off. And so finally they bit the bullet and they said, all right, fine, we'll put a DVD section in every store, but just a small one. Mm-hmm. And so they needed to clear out 1,700 titles from every store to make room for the DVD section. And so they went through and pulled off all the least renting stuff in every store. You got a report. You had to go and pull it off the shelves, and then you would stack it in a pile. And then the order came down of what we were supposed to do with the pile.
Oh, God. It's like Schindler's List.
Yeah. We had to take ball peen hammers to VHS tapes of cult films. But like, that's what we were breaking up, is we were busting up the fucking cult films. Like, this wasn't, you know, we weren't, you know, taking away like Air Force One or any of these other, you know, big, huge Schwarzenegger films. It was, go take this copy of Truck Turner out in the parking lot and fucking smash it with a hammer. And we had to sit there for 3 days straight smashing them. And the reason why we had to smash them was they did not want them going into the dumpster and having either employees or other people dumpster diving and selling them. But they didn't want to sell them either because they didn't want tables of tapes for sale taking up all that space. So they were just like, some fucking asshole at corporate thought it would be a good idea to just destroy all of this cinema with fucking hammers. And I had to do it for 3 days. And of course, it was one of those things where we were supposed to be watched by the manager so that we wouldn't steal any of the tapes. Fuck you, Blockbuster. I went home with bags of cinema some of which I still have to this day.
It's important to note, though, as Cargill tells this story about smashing tapes with a hammer, he was just following orders.
I was just following orders.
And I think it's interesting that this is a good example of the two eras of film geekery that you and I represent, because when I started working at Blockbuster, they were finally getting rid of the last VHS. They had embraced DVD to the point that they were like, okay, we need to start getting rid of all the remaining VHS. But yeah, you're right. Like that idea of working in a very corporate environment like that kind of sets up the central conflict of this movie, which we should probably discuss a little bit of the plot since we haven't done that yet.
The plot is, but we've just primed it up a bit.
We've seasoned it with our own personal experiences.
It's like being at I Love Video or Vulcan and then having the call come in that, hey, by the way, you might become a Blockbuster.
Yeah.
And having worked in both those environments, they're, you know, especially with the 90s mentality, you know, with the very American mentality of of private ownership and small business and the success of, you know, of creating your own family in your work environment, having work be a place where these characters show up just to hang out. you know, that it's that kind of a job where, hey, I'm going to go do my homework in the back before my shift.
To the point that it's hard to tell when they start arriving in this movie who actually works there.
Yes.
And who's just there to hang out. And you're right. So this movie begins with Lucas, who is an employee at Empire Records, and he's been given his first closing shift by his boss. And while in his boss's office, he discovers that their local beloved independent store is in fact about to be bought by Cockduster Video, or in this case, Music Town. And it snaps something in his head, and he takes all the money out of the safe, about $9,000, and drives his way to Atlantic City. Another easy entry point of access for a 2017 viewing of this movie, all of a sudden he's in Trump Town. It's like Trump this, Trump that, all over Atlantic City, because it's the 90s in Atlantic City. And the only other thing you see is that he passes Matt Damon and Edward Norton as they're playing poker in one of the casinos, because it's still the 90s in Atlantic City. That doesn't actually happen, but you know what I mean. So he spends, he loses.
I love Rounders.
I adore Rounders so much. If you can't spot the sucker at the table in the first 5 minutes, you are the sucker. Yeah, I love it. We're going to do that. Take a drink. So yeah,
take a drink, everybody. We're going to do Rounders.
Take a drink.
Point.
We dug into the potatoes. Now you can take a drink because Stargrove.
Stargrove.
I just went through all of our tropes in 5 seconds. So he loses
Tango.
All the money. Cash. Loses all the money at craps in about 5 minutes. And so when his boss, Joe Reeves, played by Anthony LaPaglia, speaking of So I Married an Axe Murderer, there's your crossover. And he is desperate to know what happened to this money, and he gets it out of poor God, why do I keep wanting to say Lucas? It's not loose Mark. He gets it out of poor Mark that Lucas is the one that took the money. Lucas comes in, he's trying to decide what to do, but Lucas is on this full on Kafka bent right now, so he can't even Joe can't even get through to him how serious what he did was, and then everybody finds out about Music Town. And this is my favorite part of the movie, and my favorite character moment of the movie is when Joe reveals that it's not just a simple case of him selling out. His partner in the business wants to sell to Music Town, and Joe is actually gathering money to try and buy him out so he can keep the store independent. Because I think when it makes it that it gives it that personal edge, it feels a little less like, oh man, the man's going to come in and tell us what to do, and we don't like that. Which feels very empty to this like single character. Like, no, this is my store. I actually feel very proud of it, and I don't want to sell. I'm being forced into a situation that I don't want, and I'm trying to get out of it, which makes what Lucas does like ironic. It's again, very Shakespearean. A misunderstanding leads to somebody doing something bad that they shouldn't have done, that they wouldn't have done had they known everything that was going on. It's also the basic premise of every episode of Three's Company. Ask your parents about that. So On the other side of things, we have a character played by Liv Tyler named Corey, who is really excited because today also happens to be the day at the store that they are welcoming pop sensation
Rex Manning.
Rex Manning, who, as soon as he walked into this movie, I was like, huh. And I saw the name in the credits, and I'm like, Maxwell Caulfield. I know that face. And I was like, oh, fuck me, Grease 2.
Yes, Grease
2. That's where that guy came from. I hate that I've seen Grease 2 enough to recognize Maxwell Caulfield, but I haven't seen Empire Records, nor had I seen High Fidelity enough to know that Rex Manning is not from High Fidelity. This is a problem with me as a person.
That is a very big problem as a person.
Yeah.
That you have seen Grease 2 and not either of those movies, but, or either of those movies enough.
But in the words of Master Control Program, rectified. So she is very anxious to lose her virginity to Rex Manning. She's obsessed with him. She's at the same time waiting to see if she's going to get into Harvard. So there's a lot going on for this character who's good friend of the store. Gina is played by Renee Zellweger in, I don't know how to say this without it sounding like I'm being judgmental or offensive or sexist or whatever. I've never thought of Renee Zellweger as a sex pot. I've never thought of her as that type of character. I don't know that I've ever seen her play that type of character before, but holy shit, does she pull it off in this movie?
Yeah, she sure does. And this was the first introduction for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, keep in mind that when Renee Zellweger hit the scene and started being big, a lot of us had already seen her in two movies, one Empire Records and the other a small little film called Dazed and Confused.
Yes.
So that is, you know, being the young, bubbly, sexy actress was was very much who she was and that she fought against. So it's very weird that you then, in retrospect, look back on her career and see
the more prestigious roles. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like that's when my entry point, I got to stop saying that, especially when I'm talking about female actresses. But where I first got introduced
to the male actresses
or yeah. Yeah, I'm just on a roll tonight.
You are so sensitive today.
I don't know what it is. I'm trying very hard. I mean, like Jerry Maguire is kind of like how I imagine the ascendancy of,
but
of
not Chicago.
Renee Zellweger. No, because Jerry Maguire was, I mean, that was the movie that like got everybody talking about her, and it's like, oh,
it's funny that you mentioned Jerry Maguire since the Jerry Maguire video store just opened
right?
this week.
You know what's not going to be closed in 6 months? The Jerry Maguire video store.
It's only open for a few weeks.
Oh,
it's just a,
really?
It's an artist installation.
Oh,
actually.
Okay, that makes sense.
I mean, that's being done by the Everything Is Terrible guys. Who this is where it stopped before it goes out to the desert to build the pyramid that they've been working on to build.
If you guys don't know. There were so many goddamn copies of Jerry Maguire. If you ever went to a Half Price Video or any kind of resale store that had VHS tapes, without fail, you would find two tapes, and you would find multiple copies of these two tapes. One was the two-tape edition of Titanic.
I was about to say, Titanic? Yes.
The other was Jerry goddamn Maguire, because like the E.T. game on the Atari, they made more copies of the movie than people owned VCRs. So there were just scores of extra copies of Jerry Maguire on VHS. And what this art installation in LA has done is literally filled an entire video store, all of the shelves, all of the posters, everything in the store is Jerry Maguire. It is nightmare fuel. You walk in there and you feel like you have been hit on the back of the head with a shovel. And this is the dream you're having as the blood. It's your Jacob's Ladder moment where all the blood is just seeping out of you. And this is your last moment on Earth. This is what you're seeing.
And the people working there are like a who's who of LA film people.
Yeah. Simon Barrett, in fact.
Yeah, Simon Barrett working there today. You guys will know from such films as The Guest and last year's Blair Witch.
And you're next as well. So that was my
if you like that sort of thing.
And I just realized this is not the first Renee Zellweger we've covered on Junk Food Cinema.
No, it's not.
We covered Texas Chainsaw: The Next Generation as part of the Macassar role.
Yeah, we did.
And that movie was so bad that it sat on a shelf, and by the time they got around to releasing it, both Matthew McConaughey and Renee Zellweger had hit it big enough that they threatened to never work for the studio again if they released that movie,
which
they did. So that is going on as well. And then you have the character AJ, who is desperately in love with Corey and trying to tell her how he feels. And all of these like conflicts are swirling around on Rex Manning Day. The day again, this just feels like, I feel like I'm describing Much Ado About Nothing, but I'm describing Much Ado About Empire Records, which, by the way, the phrase Much Ado About Nothing could actually describe the 90s in a very poetic way. And so all of these things are going on. All these characters are intersecting in each other's stories. Oh, and then you also have a character played by Robin Tunney, who is the very emotionally distressed character. She's a cutter. She shaves her head at the beginning of the movie. So just to complete the whole food court of 90s personalities, you have the angsty girl with the shaved head just thrown in there as well. So we have all flavors covered in one movie. And this kind of amounts to, you know, people having arguments, people coming close to getting together. I mean, your typical romantic comedy type stuff. But again, you also have a shoplifter character who comes back into the movie and has blanks and a gun.
My name's not fucking Warren.
He claims to be Warren Beatty, or that's the name that he gives police. And then he swears that he'll be back, comes back with a gun, loaded with blanks. But everybody realizes that if they just gave him a chance, maybe he would stop being so troubled. So they give him a job. Isn't that great? And then the movie ends with, oh, we've raised the money and we've done this like impromptu show and we've raised the money to buy the store back. We're going to have a big dance party on the roof. It's actually a really, for how angsty this movie is, it's a very sweet ending. Like it's a very sort of like almost saccharine happy ending, which is I'm not knocking the movie. I think
it ends with them dancing on the rooftop and them fixing the neon sign. Like
yeah.
that's you know.
You might as well have been playing, you got to put one foot in front of the other foot, because it's essentially the montage from Revenge of the Nerds. It's like, let's fix the sign, everybody's happy. And it's infectious. I will be the first to admit. It's like, I want to laugh at the movie for how dated it is, for how angsty it is. But it's like, in the end, there are stories contained here that are interesting, that I am compelled by. And the ending is, I don't know, it tugs on the right strings. And I'm like, okay, I'm totally on board for this.
Yeah, I mean, the ending is the community all coming together to support the place that they love. And you know, the movie's villain is just, he's obnoxious.
He's a yuppie.
He's a Trump kid.
He's one of the, he might be Donald Trump Jr. In fact, he actually looks a lot like Donald Trump Jr. Was it Donald Trump Jr.? I feel like I need to know this.
Like, he's this guy.
Don't make me hate this movie in retrospect.
Like, no, the thing is this guy is, you know, the villain is just this kind of smarmy, obnoxious rich kid who inherited this business from his family, doesn't care about it. Like, mm-hmm. In fact, one of the interesting things about him is he's so kind of bitter at his hippie father who changed the business into a record store that originally was bathroom fixtures. And he seems enamored with that idea. Like, the idea that, you know, he just wants to make money and instead he inherited a fucking record store and he doesn't even like it. And but it makes money because it's the 90s and it's music. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the store is big enough that they're doing $9,000 worth of sales on a weekday. So that's, you know, that is a considerable amount of money at that point in time. So of course it's a business he doesn't want to get rid of until the end, when mm-hmm. he sees that he really doesn't belong to this place, that it belongs to this family. And that's what's so great about it is. But in retrospect, in hindsight, this is a movie I think about every once in a while when I watch it, because this has become one of my travel movies. I watch it a couple times a year while I'm traveling. And the thing about it is I get so giddy and happy at the end. And then when I turn the movie off, I get sad because I think Joe bought that record store in 1995. And by 2005, all of the music stores in the country had pretty much closed. Like, they had just closed up. Like, you could not find these kind of independent music stores anywhere anymore. Because everyone had started either illegally downloading their music or buying digitally through someone like Apple. Or, you know, what would eventually happen shortly thereafter is, you know, things like Pandora and things like that. Only now has record stores started to reemerge and show back up in places as vinyl sales have increased.
Right, because that is a byproduct of the same nostalgia that causes people to look back favorably on a movie like Empire Records in the first place. So they're very much connected.
Yeah.
I think the.
But I just feel bad that Joe eventually went out of business. Like, that's.
Oh, yeah.
Like, there's a depressing movie to have come out in 2005 about the death of Empire Records, where it's like, you know, if only we had sold out earlier to Music Town, that we would have watched this fail as a Music Town as opposed to having to watch Empire Records euthanized. And like, just I just have this picture of Joe like walking out of the building and turning off the neon sign, and like, that's the actual
ending. Is that the Cheers ending? Did you just write a Cheers ending to Empire Records?
In my head, that's the ending that keeps coming up, because it's like, yay, we saved the record store for a couple of years.
You want to go where they have Alice in Chains? Do 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 do. No, I'm with you on that. But yeah, I think that's exactly what it is. I think the nostalgia that makes people, and like you said, 90s, there's certain elements of the 90s that are coming back. And I think that vinyl, that love for vinyl is a product of that. And that's probably the same reason that people go back and watch Empire Records now, a movie that did not do well on its initial release, and have developed a real fondness for it. I think it's the tendency of all humans to look back with rose-colored glasses on the past. But I feel like there are elements of the 90s that, especially when we look at what we're dealing with now, it's like, man, I kind of wish that the only problems we had were, man, all these corporate chains are coming in and taking over our local stores. Like, man, wouldn't that be great if that was the biggest thing we had to deal with? But,
you know, it's funny. There's another movie, a movie I think wrongfully got really shit on, but is also depressing in a very interesting way. It's the counter to this. It's You've Got Mail. the Tom Hanks, Meg Ryan comedy about the death of a small store at the hands of the big chain.
Which makes sense because it's based on a movie originally called Shop Around the Corner.
Yes, which I do feel is superior. And Shop Around the Corner is a Christmas movie here at our place. Old great Jimmy Stewart movie. God, I love Shop Around the Corner.
Is there a bad Jimmy Stewart movie?
Yeah, there's plenty. Mm-hmm. He made a lot of movies. But it's interesting. It would be an interesting double feature to watch this together with You Got Mail and just watch the 90s drip off onto the floor.
Who put this puddle of 90s over here?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
gotta clean this up.
You know, it's a movie about how email allows us to interact with strangers online. Mm. It's so cute.
It's like that. Watching those two movies together is like buying the Windows 95 instructional video starring Jennifer Aniston and Matthew
Perry. Yes.
You've just described that.
Have you ever watched that?
Yes, I have.
It's terrible.
Everything about what I just said is awful. Every element of the sentence that I just spoke is horrendous.
Yes.
But yeah, I have to say, as someone who just saw this for the first time, it is more than its soundtrack, and that's a compliment I can definitely pay to this movie, because if you just a cursory glance at it, that might be the only thing you think is it's a time capsule movie with a great soundtrack. But there is actually a lot going on. There's a lot of simplicity to it, but there's also a lot of like classical themes that make it very farcical and very fun. And despite its angst, is actually a very sweet movie.
Yeah.
So highly recommended.
And if you want to do a trilogy, we will do the third film here in sometime soon. I really want you to see it. I'm very looking forward to talking about it. But it starts with Times Square, which the most well-known person in that movie, of course,
Tim Curry.
Is Tim Curry, and who plays a DJ. A disc jockey, and then of course following that up is Pump Up the Volume again, a renegade talk radio guy.
I know our audience is young, but I love that you just fucking explained what the letters DJ meant. You're like a DJ, a disc jockey, because there are people, you assume there are people going to be like, the fuck is a DJ? Is that one of the characters on Full House? No, you go sit down.
Look, the word DJ has a very different meaning now.
Like, yeah, it's not a guy that shows up with his MacBook and like plays stuff that he's mixed in GarageBand.
Tim Curry is not going around to clubs, mixing music.
I'm DJ Scott.
On the radio. He's a radio personality.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's got two radio personality movies and then does the Record Store movie. And these three movies all have soundtracks that are blisteringly cool. All three of them. They've got great, interesting performances. They've got great casts. And they really, the thing that Alan Moyle did great was he captured teen angst properly. Yeah. Like all three of these movies capture what it's like to be a teenager in 1980, 1990, and 1995. Mm-hmm. And I feel like my only real sadness is that he didn't make a movie in 1985 that was a music themed movie so that we could hit all of those years.
Yeah.
I would have loved to see what type of movie he would have made in 2000 with the digital era of music. Like,
ooh, interesting.
That would have been really neat to see an Alan Moyle movie in a post-Napster age.
Pump up the bandwidth.
Something to that effect, like whatever, but how, he made really good movies about that blended music with teen drama. And,
yeah.
And it was, these are his, you go through his filmography and the rest of it is thoroughly uninteresting.
You almost said discography, didn't you?
No.
You wanted to say discography.
I did not. if you go through his filmography, I almost wanted to say cinematography, and that's not even a fucking word.
His oeuvre,
his hors d'oeuvre. But if you go through the rest of his filmography, it's not interesting. Like, there's a lot of misfires on there. There's a lot of films that are forgotten and rightfully so. A lot of stuff that doesn't work. But these three movies all stand the test of time, and all are really great and really, like, most directors would kill to have three movies that work together as well as these three do, but dear God, do they fucking work great together. So highly recommend someday fucking, you know, just start in 1980 and hit Times Square. Watch that movie that a lot of you have not seen, because it's a criminally underseen great film. Do that, then go into Pump Up the Volume, and then follow it up with fucking Empire Records. And it is the angst lessens significantly through that trilogy.
Oh yeah, that's true.
But the music stays great, and the films are all really worth watching. So definitely, that's a trilogy. That's a triple feature for any music movie loving fan.
I'm the idiot, you're the screw up, and we are all losers.
And that brings us to the junk food pairing. And when it comes to the perfect snack for watching Empire Records, say no more, Monomore. I want you to make homemade cupcakes for your man, Rex Manning. On Rex Manning Day, you got to make those cupcakes. You got to really sweeten the deal for Rex Manning to take your virginity. Which, by the way, the scene where Liv Tyler is seducing him just feels like another Aerosmith video.
Oh, it's and the way he, you know, that we did not mention that moment.
Or maybe blue cheese should have been the junk food pairing. Now that I think about it, it's disgusting.
There's a better junk food pairing, and I'll get to it in a moment. Because you really dropped the ball this week, my friend. But no,
I'll get to stepping on your dick in just a moment.
About that moment, because this is one of the most interesting things about the film is the decision of Rex Manning to do what he does. And I've always been curious. It's never really, the character motivation is not really explained. You can assume the obvious, but she is throwing herself at him. She's a teenage girl, but she's legal. She's a virgin. She wants him to take her virginity, and he's just kind of brushing her off and being polite about it. But he's not really interested. And then when she finally goes all out, he's like, are you serious about this? And she goes, yeah. And then he gets really gross and goes, all right, rock and roll, and unzips his pants and leans back. And then she's so kind of grossed out by the whole thing that she runs out.
He doesn't just lean back. He grabs blue cheese dressing as if he's going to pour it on his dick and says, I hope you like the taste of blue cheese.
That is in the director's cut version. That is
really?
Not actually in the original cut of the film.
Interesting.
That is another director's cut moment. It's again,
good,
one
because
of those...
that fucking made, not only did that make no sense to me, her reaction is so over the top appalled that I was like, what were you thinking this was going to be? You know what I mean? Like, I was like, what was the expectation?
Yeah, no, in the film, he just unzips and leans back, and then she runs out of the room, and he just goes rock and roll. And I've always wondered. Yeah, no, like I said, I'm not a big fan of the director's cut here, the extended cut, whatever they choose to call it. But in that moment, I'm wondering, is that Rex Manning being gross and finally being talked into it and being like, oh shit, she's serious. Yeah, I can totally get laid today. Or is he actually like deliberately trying to chase her off? Is he like actually being a good guy for a moment?
Yeah.
And since this film is as deeply complicated as it is, and since Alan Moyle is a director who does, in fact, add these interesting levels of character even to his villainous characters, I'm wondering if that was if I've always wondered if that's the case, if Rex Manning is actually being a good guy or if he's being a gross guy. And that is an interesting moment.
Mm-hmm.
But junk food pairing for this week, dude. Brownies with extra sugar.
Oh, yes, of
course.
With
extra sugar.
Extra sugar, which I feel like means something that it
you think
not stating think
it
explicitly.
Might actually be hot brownies?
What? No. I never thought special? That for a moment. No, I never thought that for a moment.
Yeah.
No, it is. Well, thanks for joining us here on Rex Manning Day. If you would like to hear other days that we've recorded, you can go back to Stitcher and iTunes and listen to our back catalog. You can also check us out on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, or like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. If you really like us, please do consider becoming a patron. That's how we keep the doors of Junk Food Records open, is from the patronage of junkions like you. So patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. Few shekels an episode. You get access to all the bonus content. We would appreciate it. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Twitter at Massaworm, MassaWyrm, or on Facebook, Facebook.com/Massaworm.
All right, you can find me on Twitter at Bryguy Salisbury. You can also find me on Facebook, Facebook.com/Brian Salisbury Critic. But we're going to go ahead and close our doors for the night, turn off the neon sign, and remind you, damn the man, save the empire.